Hello and welcome everyone to Leaders in Elder Care, the interview series designed to share with you some of the many people who are doing great things to change the face of elder care as we know it today. I'm Ryan Malone, founder of Inside Elder Care and your host of Leaders in Elder Care. Before we start, I'd like to remind you to subscribe to the podcast. You can do so at leadersineldercare.com by clicking on the subscribe button in the top right-hand corner. Or if you're on iTunes, you can subscribe through the normal subscription process. So let's go ahead and get started. Joining us today is Howard Gleckman. Howard is a highly regarded journalist and author. He is the author of Caring for Our Parents by St. Martin's Press that looks at how the U.S. delivers and pays for long-term services through the eyes of the elderly and disabled and the families who care for them. He is also the author of the Caring for Our Parents blog. Howard's also the editor of TaxVox, which is an economic policy blog of the Tax Policy Center. TaxVox currently receives several hundred thousand visitors and is a joint venture between the Brookings Institute and the Urban Institute. Prior to TaxVox, Howard was a senior correspondent with the Washington Bureau of Business Week, where he covered economics, tax, and budget policy, as well as healthcare, and some awards, and Howard's got a few. In 2003, he was the National Magazine Award finalist for The Coming Revolution of Healthcare. In 2004, National Magazine Award nominee for The Stealth Tax, and a 2005 Business Journalist of the Year finalist. Howard's also appeared on CNN, CNBC, C-SPAN, NPR, BBC, as well as a number of other organizations. So, Howard, I can't tell you what an honor it is to have you on the show. I personally have read a lot of your work in Business Week, and so it's truly a pleasure for me to have you on the show today.
Great to be with you, Ryan.
So, you know, let's get started. So, you know, why did you write the book? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about why you wrote it.
Sure. This all came from personal experience. Back about 10 or 11 years ago, I found myself in a position where my wife and I were caring for my father-in-law, and then at the same time caring for my dad. My dad was living in Florida with my mother. He got congestive heart failure, and for about 18 months, my wife and I were going back and forth to Florida to help my mom care for him. So I learned an awful lot about long-term care then, and being a journalist, there was a story I wanted to tell other people. I wrote a number of small articles about it, but always felt that this was something that really required a book. And a couple of years ago, I got the opportunity from the Kaiser Family Foundation. They gave me a research grant to start work on what became the book. And what I wanted to do really were a couple of things. One was give people who had not yet had this experience some sense of what it was really like to care for parents or for other disabled adults. There are stories in this book about younger people with disabilities as well. Give people a real sense of it, because I think too often people have really no idea what this is really like, what this experience really is. And the other thing I wanted them to do was learn a little bit about the system that we have and how, rather than making it easier for us to care for our parents, it actually makes it harder. And my hope was people would actually read this and get mad and say, we've got to do something to change this. This is just not acceptable for the United States of America in 2009.
So how, you mentioned that the system makes it harder. How, maybe you could give me an example of that.
Sure.
I've lived it personally, as you know, but you know, I'm sure that you have a story that you'd like to share.
Sure. Let me tell you about just one family that I met in this process. May and Walter Barrett and their daughter Michelle. Walt had dementia and Parkinson's, and over the years that I knew him, he just declined dramatically, particularly with his dementia. And he had a very, very tough time getting out of his wheelchair at first, and then eventually couldn't get out of his wheelchair at all. May, his wife, she was quite a bit younger than he was, but May did everything she could to care for him at home. She ended up quitting her job. She just struggled with the day-to-day problems that somebody in that situation has. For example, Walt weighed about 190 pounds, May weighed about 90, and just getting him up out of bed and into his wheelchair was a huge struggle. May not only sacrificed much of her time and her career to do this, but her daughter Michelle, who was an Air Force pilot, gave up her career. And of course, being an Air Force pilot, especially if you're a woman, is a big deal. And she gave that up so she could live closer to her parents and help out as best as she could. And they got no support. Walt was in a situation where he had a big enough pension that he was never going to get any sort of government assistance for this. And they were just looking for the most basic kinds of help, not even money, but they were looking for information. May was desperate to try to find somebody who could help her learn how to transfer Walt without falling and hurting herself. And then there was the time when they were trying to get a combination wheelchair commode so that she wouldn't have to transfer him from the wheelchair onto the toilet and back again, which, of course, were opportunities for him to fall. And they couldn't get Medicare to pay for it. Medicare told them it was a convenience item and that they wouldn't pay for the thing. So that's the kind of thing that happens to families all the time. It's just we have this system that just makes it more and more difficult to provide the care that people really want to provide their loved ones.
Wow. Yeah, it seems like that there's a growing population of people who aren't poor enough to be able to get help, but don't have enough money necessarily to get the help that they need.
No, that's exactly right. There are these people who are caught in the middle. I mean, Medicaid, which is the government program that pays for long-term care, is available to people once they've run out of money. The way you get on to Medicaid is onerous. It's very difficult. You have to be very sick and very poor. But once you're on, Medicaid does provide at least a beginnings of some assistance. People who are very wealthy, of course, can afford to buy whatever care they need. If you happen to have long-term care insurance, maybe that will help you do it. But there are an awful lot of people, there are millions of people in this country who are caught in between. They can't afford long-term care insurance, they don't have the savings they need, and they're not poor enough for Medicaid, and they're just caught. They're stuck in this Neverland.
So how then do people pay for long-term care in the country?
Well, generally what happens is people spend all the money they have. They go through the bank account. They sell whatever stocks they have. Maybe they end up selling the house. And then they just end up on Medicaid. Medicaid, as I say, provides this basic care. Many people, the real tragedy is there are many people out there who aren't getting care at all. There are probably 10 million people in the United States who need long-term care. And many of them aren't getting it. Many of them, the saddest thing to me are those mostly very elderly widows who live alone in an apartment or in maybe a small row house in any city in America who just die. And they've got nobody. Nobody even knows. You talk to EMTs or police officers, and they tell you, you know, more often than you want to think about, you know, we're called to a home and we find somebody who died a week ago, and nobody knew it. So there's we talk about the safety net in this country, but the safety net for long-term care has a lot of big holes in it.
Yeah, in fact, you know, you mentioned I read a story just this morning, actually, of a woman who fell and broke her hip and I guess wasn't able to reach anybody and sat there for 14 or 15 hours before she passed away.
Yeah. It happens a lot.
That's heartbreaking.
And it is heartbreaking. And you know, what's beginning to happen now is you have women who outlive their whole families. Their husbands die, their children have died, and their friends have died, and they're literally alone. And then you think about the baby boom generation and even the following generations and the way our families are so different than they used to be. Children live thousands of miles away from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
There are many childless couples, gay couples who may have no children, people who are divorced, who may be estranged from spouses or from children. In all of these situations, you have families that are just not structured to take care of you when you become frail and elderly.
So, obviously, you know, when you look through the book, it's amazing the amount of research that you did. I mean, every page is packed very densely with a ton of research. Surely you found, you know, are there some new ways to help people stay out of nursing homes?
There are some ways. Right. Yeah, there are some ways, and there actually are some ways to make nursing homes better, too. There are a couple of things going on in communities that I think are really interesting. One of them involves the idea of bringing services to people where they already live. And there's a movement out there called the Village Movement. This began in Boston on Beacon Hill. It's happening, I live in the Washington, D.C. area. It's happening on Capitol Hill in Washington. Happening in a lot of places where neighbors get together. They form basically a co-op, and you pay an annual fee of somewhere between $500 and $1,000. And for that, you get access to all kinds of community services. And the idea is to provide you with enough assistance so that you can stay home and you don't need to move to an assisted living facility or a nursing home. The biggest single, the most common request for assistance at Capitol Hill Village is transportation. It's nothing more complicated than somebody who needs a neighbor to help give them a ride to the doctor or the grocery store or pick up a prescription for them at the drugstore. That's really all it takes. So what they've done at Capitol Hill Village is they put together a list of volunteers, and then they put together a list of people who need help. People who need help make a phone call, and the office calls the volunteer and says, can you take Mrs. Jones to the grocery store at 2 o'clock? And just that kind of very simple assistance can make the difference between being able to stay at home and having to move into a nursing home. This is entirely community-based. There's no government involvement at all. On the other hand, there are government programs, and they exist in what they call naturally occurring retirement communities. And these may be neighborhoods, they may be apartment buildings, where people have essentially aged in place, and you have a large number of elderly people in one place. And the government can send people to help them do exercises, or aides can go and visit a number of different residents on one trip. So there are a lot of ways you can do that. And the third one I want to mention just briefly is something called the PACE program. And the PACE program is a program that's actually jointly run by Medicare and Medicaid. It's unusual in that sense. And that provides adult daycare and medical assistance all in one place. So that you go for the day, you get breakfast and lunch, you get activities during the course of the day, you get to meet other people because staying at home can be very isolating. And then if you need medical assistance, the docs are right down the hall and you can get that too. So there are a lot of programs that are starting to pop up that are available for people who are kind of living where they've been living for years. You kind of bring the services to them. The other model, which is in some ways even more interesting, is what they call intentional communities. And the idea there is a group of people who share some interest can move in together into a large house or into an apartment complex or whatever it might be, and just agree to care for one another for as long as they can. And they range. I met a fascinating woman in the course of researching the book named Dean Patterson. Dean is a former nun who lived in southwestern Virginia, in a very rural part of the country. And she started a community. Originally, it was started for elderly nuns, retired nuns. And then it was expanded so that it now serves people of all faiths who share kind of a spiritual interest. And they have, what in the 1960s we would have called a commune. People who are living together in private apartments who take care of one another and put money into a kitty so that if people need paid help, they can do that. In Burbank, California, there's a place where retired actors and artists live in an apartment building, and they do the same thing. So it almost doesn't matter what your interest can be, but it's a way for people to come together and help each other out. So there are some interesting models out there.
You know, it's funny that with all the technology and out there today that, you know, still a list of folks who want to help connected with a list of folks who need help by a telephone still seems to be the most effective way to do it. Because regardless of what kind of tools you send out there, you know, you still fundamentally have to have one person that wants to help another person.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's pretty low tech when you think about it. But if people are willing, it really can help. The question is, that's all great. All those models are terrific. There's 1,000 flowers blooming. Some of them are going to work. Some of them aren't. They're really interesting. But the big question is, how are we going to pay for all this stuff? And at some point, you need paid assistance. You know, your friends just can't help. You're too sick.
Right.
And where's the money going to come from? How are we going to pay for it?
So what does long-term care then mean for caregivers?
long-term care is overwhelming for caregivers. It's, you know, it's really kind of funny, Ryan. You know, that they talk about paid assistance. In the United States, we pay $230 billion a year for paid assistance. And then they have what they call informal assistance, or sometimes they call it free. And whenever I hear that word free, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, because having done it myself and having met with lots of people who are going through this experience now, the last thing this is free. The cost in terms of time and physical abilities and emotional strength is just tremendous. You know, somebody like May, it's just crushing her. Another family I met up outside of Burlington, Vermont, Judy and Steve Dow. Steve is a contractor. Judy was a teacher. They were trying to take care of Steve's mom, who had advanced Alzheimer's. They were trying to take care of Judy's parents, who didn't have anything particularly wrong with them. They were just becoming quite frail. And they were trying to raise two high school age kids. And one day, Steve came home for dinner, and dinner wasn't ready, and Judy was just sitting at the kitchen table in tears. And she just said, you know, I can't do it anymore. I just can't do it. And they made a decision then that Steve's mom was going to have to go into assisted living facility. The burden on caregivers is just tremendous. And it's, you know, my own experience was, it was in many ways, it was the most rewarding thing I ever did in my life. It was an opportunity to give something back to my parents, who, of course, had done so much for me when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So that part was great. It really was rewarding, but it was also very hard. It was hard to concentrate on work. It was hard to keep my own family together. It was not an easy thing.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I read an article in the New York Times a few weeks ago, and they were talking about an example of a family who needed to get a third-party caregiver, and they had decided that, you know, since the family member at the time herself was, you know, more trusted by her parents, and, you know, they had that family bond, that rather than pay a private caregiver, they were going to pay the child, because the child was going to give up her job, mm-hmm, to be able to take care of it. And the comments on the blog were, you know, completely on different ends. So, you know, you had one group that thought they were all for it, and you had another group that were so offended that people would take pay from their parents to do it. But it was clear to me that some of the people that made the comments had never been in that situation. I know when my mom went into assisted living, it ended up being a very good experience, because she needed a lot of therapy that I couldn't necessarily give her. But you're still saddled with so much guilt of moving them out of the house. And, you know, if you don't get to go visit a day because you have another commitment, there's a ton of guilt there that really puts the strain on parts of your life that are really hard to articulate unless you've done it.
That's really true. It's really, really true. And it's interesting because, you know, in some countries, for example, in Germany, they have a national long-term care insurance system. You pay 2% of payroll every month. It's like a sort of an additional payroll tax, small payroll tax. And for that, you essentially buy a long-term care insurance policy. And what's interesting is, in Germany, you can get the benefit in cash. France has the same system. You get a cash benefit. And essentially, you can do anything you want with that. And if you want to hire your daughter or your next-door neighbor to provide care, you just do it. And nobody thinks it's unusual. Nobody's surprised by it. And it's a system that works very well. If, on the other hand, you want to use the money to build a wheelchair ramp, you can do that. The money is really for you to use as you feel most appropriate. And, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, in the United States, we you know, children make enormous sacrifices for their parents, and those people who don't do it seem to think, well, that's what the kids just are supposed to do. But when the time comes for you to do it and you've got to balance your family and your job and your parents and all the rest of it, it's just extremely, extremely difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting also the cultural differences here, whereas, you know, especially like in Europe, you know, where my wife's from the Ukraine, or in Asia or even Latin America, it's very common to take the family member into the house, and it seems like in the U.S. that's very difficult. I think part of it's distance, like you mentioned before, and, you know, part of it is just that we haven't been kind of ingrained in our culture that the type of respect that you have and the type of wisdom that, you know, some of the older folks have
I think that's right. I think one of the things that's very sad, and you know, I saw this frequently when I go to visit nursing homes. We want to protect our children from seeing people who are very ill or people who are dying. So often what I would find would be, you know, the adult child of someone who is very ill. And I'd ask them, you know, has your son or daughter visited their grandmother? And the answer often is, well, you know, I don't want them to see grandma like this. And I think that's a real mistake. I think it's very important that children see what life is like. They see what happens when you're frail and old. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful for grandma in that situation to feel that she's still part of the family. And it's a lesson for the kids, because, you know, one of the things that they learn that may be a surprise is somebody who's very ill and very old isn't scary. There's someone you can still love, and there's someone you can still learn from, and you can still have fun with. Maybe not in some ways you used to, but maybe in other ways. You know, you can listen to your grandmother, if she's still able, tell stories about what her life was like when she was a kid, when she was your age. You know, there's a lot that elderly people have to give. And when adult children decide they're going to separate their kids from their parents, it really steals a lot from both of those generations. And then what it does, I think, is it makes it less likely that when you know, the next generation comes along, that their kids are going to want to care for them at home. We feel that, you know, just put them somewhere and it'll be fine, and that's not the way it ought to be.
So going back to, you made a comment about long-term care insurance, and you mentioned Germany and France. So is long-term care insurance a good buy, based on your experience?
It depends. I hate to cop out on you, but it's really true. You know, people ask me, you know, should I buy health insurance? The answer is yes, of course. If they ask me, you know, should I buy auto insurance or homeowners insurance? The answer is, well, you have to. You don't have any choice. The question is, should I buy long-term care insurance? I think you've got to ask yourself a number of questions. You know, how much money do you have? How much income do you make every year? If you're very, very wealthy, that you can perhaps self-insure and not have to buy the insurance. If you have assets of less than $50,000, it probably doesn't make any sense to buy insurance, because if you have catastrophic long-term care costs, you're going to be on Medicaid anyway. What's your health status? What's your family medical history? What's the deal with your kids? Since long-term care insurance is in some ways asset preservation insurance, you know, what I tell people is, if you've got, you know, two kids and your daughter's a doctor and your son's a lawyer, you probably don't need to worry about preserving assets for them. They can take care of themselves.
Right.
If, on the other hand, you know, your daughter is a violinist and your son has perhaps a developmental disability, well, then you absolutely need to think about saving money for them. So I think there's no clear answer. Long-term care insurance, as you know, is not cheap. For a 60-year-old, a policy can easily be $2,000. For a 65-year-old, it can be $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be expensive. You can buy it younger, in which case it's a lot less costly, but you're going to be paying premiums for many more years. So it really depends. I mean, you really have to stop and think about what your tolerance for risk is, what your financial situation is, what your family is like, what your medical history is like, and really make your own decision.
So, yeah, I mean, that stuff is still so hazy. I mean, there's five different ways that you can pay for this stuff, and I'm doing a bunch of research in that area now myself, and
mm-hmm.
none of it's really clear and cut and dry like health insurance or any of that.
No,
stuff.
It's not. It's not, and it's very complicated. That's the other thing. And remember, the biggest challenge is, you know, you're going to buy this insurance. Even if you buy it at 60, there's a good chance you're not going to need it for 20 years. And, you know, what's the technology going to be like in 20 years? What's your health status going to be like in 20 years? Is
right.
the insurance company still going to be in business in 20 years? There's a lot of imponderables.
Yeah, make sure you get the inflation right, or otherwise it doesn't really matter.
Absolutely. That one is a no-brainer. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, in the book, so what was your favorite part of the book?
Well, my favorite part of the process of writing the book was the time I spent with these families. It was just extraordinary, you know, the fact that they welcomed me into their homes, that I was able to spend a couple of years visiting them, learning about their lives, learning how hard it was, but also, you know, really how much love these families had for one another. that was by far the most interesting part for me. You know, talking to the policy experts and the economists and the doctors was all interesting enough, but spending time with those families was just great. And I hope that one of the things I was able to do in the book is give people an idea of what those stories were. And, you know, they were not all sad stories. You know, people were in very difficult situations physically. They were, you know, quite ill. But some of the stories were just amazing and really uplifting. One of the people that I met who was just extraordinary was Peggy Ingalls. Peggy's actually not elderly. Peggy's just in her 40s. But she was injured in a very, very bad horse riding accident and had a high spinal cord injury, essentially was a paraplegic after this injury. And she was told after she was hurt that this is the way her life was going to be, and she just wasn't ever going to get better. And Peggy looked at the doctors and looked at the physical therapist and said, you know what, screw you. I'm not going to just sit here and take what you have to say. And she did the most incredibly intense regimen of physical therapy. She found a place called the Kennedy Krieger Institute that did some cutting-edge work in physical therapy for people with her kinds of injuries. And she has come back a long, long way. And just spending time with Peggy and watching her spirit and just how, you know, she's one of these people with this incredible, you know, infectious, charismatic personality, which is wonderful. It just made me feel great every time I go see her.
That's fantastic. It just shows you the attitude means so much.
Absolutely.
And outlook. So I got to ask you a future question. So,
sure.
You know, obviously, you know, you're in D.C., you know, you write about politics, you write about healthcare. So, you know, put your crystal ball in front of you. You know, what are we looking at for the next 5-10 years? What do you think are going to be the things that are going to happen that are going to make things better? What do you think might be the things that we fall short on?
Well, I think on the delivery side, I think we're going to see more experiments in home care, in alternatives to nursing homes, in creative new kinds of nursing homes. I think the baby boomers are going to demand these kinds of changes. They're not going to accept the kind of institutional hospital-like nursing homes that their parents and grandparents had to live in.
Mm-hmm.
So I think on that side, we're going to see a lot of experiments. We're going to see things like these villages, like these intentional communities where people really come together and try to help one another, and whether they do it through neighborhoods or whether they do it through churches or synagogues or whether they do it through some other, you know, maybe it's going to be the internet, I don't know, that, you know, they're going to find ways to do this. On the payment side, and that's all going to happen. I mean, it's inevitable it's going to happen. There are people out there who are looking for ways to make it work. On the payment side, I think we have to make a fundamental decision, and it's actually in many ways the same decision we have to make about healthcare, which is, do we want to provide some sort of basic long-term care insurance for everybody? Is this something that we think is important enough to society that we're going to just do it? And you can do this in a way that it doesn't bust the budget. You can do this in a way so people are paying market rates for their policies.
Mm-hmm.
But you can create a system where essentially everybody will have at least some long-term care insurance and some access to at least a basic level of care. Do we think that that's something important, or don't we? Senator Kennedy has legislation that he wants to include as part of health reform. It's called the CLASS Act, and that's what this would do. It would provide a basic long-term care insurance program for everyone. You know, is Congress going to pass this? Hard to say. Just the other day, President Obama said that he supports it. It's the first word we've heard from him on long-term care since he's been elected president.
Mm-hmm.
But will it make it? I don't know. I think if it doesn't happen this year, it's probably going to happen over the next few years. But we can't keep going on like we are.
Yeah, clearly. I hope so. It's funny that, you know, when I talk to some younger friends, they don't understand the impact of especially long-term care type things. But then when you talk to some of the ones that are, you know, have some older parents, all of a sudden, you know, they're looking around, you know, asking for help. And if we can convince people that, you know, it's far less expensive to ask for it earlier than later, I think we'll be in good shape.
No, that's for sure.
You know, so, cool. So, well, fantastic. So before we sign off here, can you share with the listeners, you know, where can they find the book? Where can they learn a little bit about you? And, you know, maybe where can they find some of your writing?
Sure. You can get the book anywhere. It's Caring for Our Parents, and you get it on Amazon. You can get it in your local bookstores. I'm always a fan of supporting neighborhood bookstores, but wherever you want to buy it, it should be available. I have a website, which is howardgleckman.com, and my last name is spelled G-L-E-C-K-M-A-N, so it's howardgleckman1word.com, or you can go to caringforourparents.com and find it there. I've also got a blog, which you can get to from that website. And recently I've started writing a column for the Kaiser Health News Service, which you can get on the web as well, doing a twice-a-month column on long-term care issues as well. So there are plenty of places you can read this stuff. What I really hope, as I said, is that people read this, get some sense of what long-term care is really like, begin to plan for it, and also maybe get mad enough so that they can call their politician friends and say that we have to fix the system. We just can't keep doing this like we're doing it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. So, Howard, thank you so much for your time. It's really been a pleasure, like I mentioned. I'm a big fan, and we appreciate your time with us today. We appreciate you being a leader in elder care. For our listeners, a reminder, be sure to check out two websites. One is Inside Elder Care. It's a by families, for families approach to helping families with elder care issues. It's at insideeldercare.com, and Portrait of Our Parents, which is a storytelling website designed to share the brilliant memories of our elders. So all those stories and memories that you have as a kid that you want to memorialize on the web, it's reached at portraitofourparents.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Hope to see you again soon, and have a great day.
Thanks a lot, Ryan.